ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Roger Montgomery, Chief Investment Officer from Montgomery Investment Management, is with us again. Roger, evening. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Always great to be with you, Phil.
Have you got an electric car?
No, and I won't be buying one.
Oh, okay.
Not for a while. That doesn't mean
that's a rather pugnacious response.
I know, indeed.
I would have thought you were at the forefront of trends, Roger.
No, I've thought about it a lot and written about it as well. And I think my wife and I sat down and we went through all the advantages and disadvantages and the concerns that I have. And so on that basis, we're holding off for the time being. And part of the thesis is, or part of the reason for that, is because of my investigation for the investment opportunities that have abounded in the EV space and in the lithium ion battery space. And where I've got to is that I don't know that the current technology for electric vehicles, which is predominantly lithium ion batteries, I don't know whether that's going to be the dominant technology. And I think some other technologies might be superior, and governments appear around the world to be moving. If you look at the UK, for example, they're moving in a direction where they're delaying postponing the phase out of petrol and diesel cars. And in the UK, they've done that by 5 years. So they've pushed it out from 2030 to 2035. Now, what that means, particularly if other governments follow suit, and the reason why that's happening, I'll explain in a minute. But if other countries follow that, if their move is replicated in other places, then what it will do is it will slow down EV sales. And there's a host of reasons why they're already slowing down. You mentioned Germany, down 29%.
Yeah, I don't know whether I know it's down, but is this a trend? Is it significant? I mean, there are all sorts of reasons why you might get fluctuations in a market which has been pretty hot, and you've got China, you know, pumping out thousands of these things and with the potential to flood the market. I mean, there are market reasons for it, or you think there's more fundamental reasons?
I think the market forces are definitely helping to slow EV sales. There's also some anxiety around the technology, which I'll talk about in just a minute. But if what the UK has done is repeated elsewhere, what that will do is it will increase consumer concerns about the resale values of their older cars. So if you're buying an EV today, there's already some questions over the resale value, over the recycling of the battery, and over the insurance premiums that are being posed on those vehicles, because even if there's only very, very minor damage to the battery, the whole car tends to be written off by insurers. So to compensate them for their requirement to do that from a safety standpoint, the premiums have gone up relative to ICE or internal combustion engine cars. So that aside, the resale values will drop. And so because there's no urgency to purchase an EV, and many more years will pass before the requirement to switch or before people are forced to switch, it then becomes a desirable to have, not a must have. And so the resale value of the older models will continue to plummet, and that'll act as a disincentive to buy current model EVs, and that'll feed further falls in demand. But look, what we know is in Germany, we've seen a significant drop in year-on-year sales for the March quarter.
What's that about?
It's for some of the reasons that we've talked about, but it's higher EV prices. They're typically 50% more than a petrol equivalent. There aren't many cheaper models, although Tesla's promised to bring one out, and China's working on that as well. Consumers have concern about range, obviously. They have concern about insufficient charging infrastructure. The resale values that I mentioned just a moment, we talked about the higher insurance premiums. And then there's some people who have concerns about the recycling of lithium ion batteries. And the other fact is that in terms of carbon footprint, it's currently estimated that developing or producing an EV, a pure EV, a battery EV vehicle, has about a 40% larger footprint on the environment, environmental footprint. To offset that, they have to be more efficient, which they are.
But over the life of the vehicle, their footprint is probably significantly less.
And you have to drive it a lot to offset that. So if most, and what we've found in Australia at least, is because of that range anxiety, most EV, I don't want people ringing up saying, oh, I drive mine a long way, I drive it interstate. I know there are a few, proportionally there are a few people who do drive their EVs long distances, but it's a disproportionately small number. Most people drive their EVs in urban areas over short distances, and so they're not offsetting that greater environmental impact for the car.
Mind you, Roger, that is true for people with all cars. I mean, most people don't drive long distances in their cars. And some people do, but mostly.
Exactly.
Most people use their cars for driving around town.
That's right. So if we have two vehicles that are driving the same distances and it's not very much around town, but the manufacturer of the traditional conventional engine car has a much, much smaller environmental footprint in terms of its manufacture, then the net benefit is greater for that vehicle. Now, that's counterintuitive, but it seems to be the case, and it's having some effect. Now, I think Toyota's chairman, Akio Toyoda, with a D, he's proving to be something of a prophet. So earlier this year, back in January, he said the reason why Toyota is not going hell for leather down the BEV, battery electric vehicle route, is because he thinks that electric vehicles will only ever make up about 30% of global new car sales. He thinks there's better technology. And of course, they've spent, if you look at Lexus and Toyota, they've been working on hybrid engines for a very, very long time now. And they now sell, Lexus, for example, sells their hybrid vehicles with a 10-year warranty on the system, on the hybrid system. Ram has created what's called a parallel electric vehicle. And so what that does is there is a petrol engine in it, but the petrol engine is not connected to the wheels. The petrol engine is a generator that charges the battery, and the battery drives the wheels. And so they're getting 1,100 miles out of their test vehicles from this parallel system, or parallel hybrid system, I should say, which means you don't have to charge the battery or you don't have to fill the petrol tank for 1,100 miles, which is a significant leap on even ICE engine cars. So, and it may counterintuitively provide a shorter path to decarbonisation than bans on the sale of conventional vehicles. So, you know, I think that we could see some bumps in demand, or the bump that's currently being experienced in demand for EVs. And across the European Union, by the way, Phil, there's been an 11% decline last month. And also in Norway, which is, and I think this might be slightly different, by the way, I think the reasons for Norway are a bit different. They've seen last month their hybrid vehicles, battery electric vehicles fall by half. Now, I think that's a saturation issue over there. That 90% of their fleet now is electric. So once everyone's got one, you're going to see a decline in sales. But I'm just not convinced that, you know, and we've seen this in technology throughout time, that the first iteration of an alternative to a conventional technology, the first iteration may not be the winner. It may not be the one that becomes widely adopted. And so, you know, in Toyota's argument, you know, they're saying that other technologies.
When they say that, though, the only feasible alternative, which is having any impact at all, is Toyota's hybrid technology. I mean, Toyota have mucked around with hydrogen cars, but they're nowhere in the sense of being ready to roll out in any meaningful way, even though you can, in theory, buy one.
Yes.
But, you know, there's no refueling network at all and no means for for distributing hydrogen in that way. I mean, no, when you say other right. technologies, there's not really any other technology other than hybrid engines, is there?
At the moment, but give it time and who knows. You know, one thing I've learned about investing in technology is it's very, very hard to predict its evolution.
That's true. Yeah.
You know, it's very, very hard. Now, I know that typically when you think about technology, typically, you know, there's an element of new technology tends to be a combination of previous technologies, and within the new technology, there are components, and each one of those components is a technology in itself. But what we know is new technology always seems to harness some natural phenomena. And so I just think it's still too early to settle on battery, lithium ion batteries. We also know it's an extremely dirty process to extract. We also know that that the technology itself, or the lithium ion itself, is primarily sourced from China. So you've got geopolitical risk there as well. So
although that technology itself, though, Roger, is, I mean, in a sense, it may well be that they'll invent a better battery. That wouldn't change the rationale for the switch to electric cars. I mean, there's, you know, there have been the development of solid state batteries already. There undoubtedly will be a better battery, but does that really change much about the argument?
I think given where we stand today, I do think that, you know, let's take I think it was Hertz in the United States. They have stopped buying electric vehicles for their fleet. They've done that because they're finding them almost impossible to sell secondhand, and they're not willing to pay the insurance premiums on them. And, you know, what you see in scale from a car rental company will be the experience of individuals. And once that sort of experience gains traction, then you'll find that the current slump in sales may actually continue. And, you know, and we're seeing the effects of that. Tesla's response to declining demand, for example, they've sacked 14,000 people, which is about 10% of their workforce. And they're doing that because the downturn in sales is real. And so, you know, this is happening. It's happening right now. You were talking about new technologies, and you mentioned solid-state batteries. Well, it was only last week, that a company called Natron Energy, it's commissioned a commercial factory for the production of sodium ion batteries. Now, sodium is, you know, freely available and available in, you know, at 1,000 times the quantity of lithium, and it's available in geopolitically risk-free places. And so there's the power that's generated from these sodium ion batteries is not enough really for mobility. It's not really enough for cars, but for battery storage and for example, fast charging stations and data centers, it's perfect. And so what you might find is that demand for lithium declines. And that counterintuitively could actually be a good thing for demand, because it could bring down the price of the manufacturing of battery electric vehicles. And you see, this is the challenge. There's a few moving parts. It's hard to predict how it's going to play out. But in answer to your question, there's not sufficient compelling reasons for me to go out and buy an EV today. Mm.
You may be compelled to, in the sense that governments worldwide are committed to lowering emissions, and cars, of course, are a principal cause of those emissions. They'll mandate the fact that fossil fuel burning cars, petrol and diesel cars, can't be registered new from a certain date. I mean, some countries have already done this, and Australia hasn't done this, but will eventually, I suspect, and not necessarily recently. But so in that sense, the argument, I mean, your hand's going to be forced at some point, isn't it? Because it is, I mean, the emissions argument is a cogent one.
Well, as I mentioned in the beginning, Britain's just pushed out. They've just pushed out their mandate for another 5 years to 2035. So there's no rush to go and buy one now. Yes, you might be right. The other problem that we've got is there's probably not enough lithium at the moment for present technology batteries to fill the fleet, the global fleet of cars. If everyone was mandated to buy an EV today, they couldn't get them. And even if production was ramped up by all the manufacturers of the world, it would drive the price of lithium, because supply can't keep up. It would drive the price of lithium to such an extreme that nobody could afford to buy those cars anyway. Mm.
In investment terms, you'd say get out of the EV sector.
Well, I don't think Tesla's share price, I don't think its price to earnings ratio, which, by the way, is the second highest of all car manufacturers in the world, yeah, barring Ferrari. Ferrari is the only one that has a higher price to earnings multiple as Tesla, and Tesla's sales are declining. I don't think its PE is justified. I wouldn't be buying Tesla today, but there are a lot of people who disagree with me. There are a lot of people who say it's not just a car company. It's doing other things. Mm. A whole bunch of things. And that's true, but you can't value those things because those things aren't making any money. So based on the business as it stands today, as an investor, I wouldn't be buying Tesla. Sure, I could speculate on some of those other things winning, but that's speculating. That's not investing. Based on the earnings profile of the business today and its sales declines, it's not worth the price to earnings multiple it's trading on at the moment.
Michael says, can we move away from cars talk and talk about investing? We are, Michael. We are talking about investing. Mark from St Kilda's on the line too. G'day, Mark.
How are you?
Not bad.
I've got a fair bit of understanding around this, and I think that there's, if we're looking at it from an investment perspective rather than electric car perspective, I'm talking to you from my electric car, but that's a totally different thing. I think that what we're missing here is the redundance of technology, and that diesel engines are going to be regulated out of the industry, and what you've got is companies like Toyota that are at risk of going broke. And people laugh about the biggest car manufacturer in the world doing that, but if they fail to adapt as quickly as they need to, all they need to do is lose 10% of their global sales. And then they've lost all their productivity. They've got these legacy legacy plants that are worth nothing but the land value. And I guess that, you know, from my industry perspective, Toyota are part of the problem because they have the biggest, they have 7 full-time lobbyists in Canberra. They are against what they don't participate in. And I think that if you look at an EU report that came out about 2 months ago, so they mandated in the EU for manufacturers to provide the real-world fuel economy and emissions figures from their vehicles. And what that found is that the hybrid and the plug-in hybrid vehicles were 4 times what they were stipulated. So you've got this situation where we've got a move towards efficiency, and yes, there are limited resources to be able to build this, and battery technology is moving, but the focus should be on the redundancy of the legacy manufacturers, and the fact that if I was putting my money, I wouldn't put money into Tesla. Tesla's well overpriced, but I think Toyota and many of those other organisations are a bigger risk because they don't have anything to move into, whereas a company like Tesla, which is an energy company, and when you get to vehicle to grid type aspects of it, where you can plug your car in, you can use that to zero out your power bills, all of those sort of grid based technologies. This is where I think that argument flips itself on its head from an investment perspective.
Yeah, interesting, Mark. Thank you, mate. Interesting. Appreciate it.
I agree with what you're saying, and you highlighted the point that I made earlier, and that is that, you know, these parallel hybrid vehicles are really just shooting hitting the ball out of the park in terms of real world efficiency gains. And what we might find is, as I said earlier, we might actually find that counterintuitively, that's the way we go. We don't all dive into battery electric vehicles immediately. We end up, with a shorter path to decarbonisation through hybrid, rather than a ban on the sale of ICE vehicles. I look, from an investment perspective, my experience over the last 30 odd years has been that new technology is really challenging to invest in because you can't know who the winner is going to be. You can't know what technology is going to be the dominant technology. I agree. One of the things that Elon Musk has done is he's changed the narrative for good. This is a permanent shift towards a cleaner solution. I'm just not sure that BEV or lithium-ion battery electric vehicles is the solution. And for that reason, well, I agree, and I also agree, I said earlier that Tesla isn't, I don't think, investment quality at the moment. There's some hope around its other technologies and its other business units, but that is hope. But I think all car manufacturers are really tough business to be in.
Sure.
And I wrote a piece about that many years ago.
That observation, Roger, that are there any car manufacturers that started out manufacturing cars that still exist? And the answer, I think, is no.
You're right. We talked about that a few years ago. But, there's been something like 2,000 car manufacturers in the United States since Carl Benz in the late 1800s drove his first horseless carriage around that park and his wife, Bertha, stole it and drove it to another town and then did some shopping and came back. There's been 2,000 manufacturers in the United States, and I think there are none today bar one, and I think that's Tesla, that are generating an operating profit that haven't been bailed out by government or private equity in the process. So we've gone from 2,000 to about 4 or 5, and of those that still exist, only Tesla hasn't been bailed out by government.
Just before we get
at some point in its life.
Just before we get off this topic, I was reading interesting. I'd love your comment about this from an investment point of view as well, because I know that some big and wealthy investors in the United States have invested heavily in EVs in China, which is now easily the biggest manufacturer of electric cars. I mean, I think there's more than 100 manufacturers in China. There may be more, but
BYD.
There's not just them. I mean, that's just one. You know, there's hundreds of there's dozens and dozens and dozens of manufacturers. But it's said that the production of EVs in China is going to pose some sort of existential threat for EV makers everywhere if they have to offload these things.
Yeah, and you know, there's some objection in the United States. I don't think you can buy a BYD or Chinese electric vehicle in the US at the moment. There's some, whether they're conspiracy theorists or, you know, extreme right-wing conservatives, I don't know. I don't want to talk about the political side of it. But there's objections to them entering the United States because of the data that they're collecting on drivers and the data that they're collecting from, location information and also the cameras on them. So it could be that their growth is somewhat limited by, government objections to their sales in various countries. Who knows? We'll wait and see. But that's just another element, to the investment case for these businesses.
This technology, that's right. It's one of those gee whiz moments, isn't it, when you probably were okay if you were there at the beginning and probably sensible if you're off it now. So you'll love this question from Craig on the Hume. G'day, Craig.
G'day, Phil, and g'day, Roger. I've got a question for Roger, and I realise that Roger cannot give personal investment advice, so I'm not seeking that. But I just wanted to discuss with him. I've been trading cryptocurrencies on Swift for 37 months now. Now I've never traded shares, but I would just like to just discuss my results and see how Roger feels about whether maybe I'm having success or whether I should be looking at other things. I've only put $17,000 into it at the moment, and my portfolio at the moment has increased by 33% as it sits today, and I'm averaging my minimum profit on each trade is 25%. I started out just doing.
I'll tell you what, Craig. This is interesting. This is interesting. I've just got to get some other people to join the program here. So stay there. Don't hang up. I've got you on hold because I know plenty of other people would like to hear about this as well, but we just need to put our big national audience together, so let's do that.
This is Nightlife with Phil Clark
on ABC Radio.
Now, And we're talking finance on Nightlife with Roger Montgomery. And Craig's just asked a question on the Hume Highway about Bitcoin trading. If you'd like to ask any questions at all about investment or investment prospects, then Roger's your man. He can't give personal financial advice, but market advice, ask him what his view is. 1-300-800-222. 1-300-800-222 is the number. Craig, back to you. So you were saying that your Bitcoin trading so far is...
No, I'm not trading Bitcoin. I'm trading cryptocurrency. I buy and hold Bitcoin and Ethereum. I trade hundreds of other cryptocurrencies.
Bitcoin is a bit of shorthand.
I just wanted to ask Roger, because I've been doing it for 37 months. Mm-hmm. My portfolio, I started with $17,000. I've managed to grow it by 33% as it sits at the moment. Mm-hmm. And I'm averaging 20. My minimum profit is 25% on each trade. I was just wondering what Roger's thoughts are on how he thinks to see my achievements so far and what he feels the future is for trading of cryptocurrencies.
Rog?
Sure. Look, we've talked about this at length before. Let me ask you a few very specific questions, which I'm hoping you can answer for me.
Yes, I can.
In the 37 months, is there a period that you can point to where you've made most of those gains? And is it in the last 12 months that you've made most of those gains?
I've made most of those gains probably in the last 18 months.
Yeah, okay, since the start of...
There have been a handful of currencies that I've bought into that have been delisted, so I've actually lost a little bit of money on those, but I'm only doing $5 trades. I might, for example, have a couple of $100 invested in one currency. What I'm doing is I'm buying in at $5 increments, for example, setting up to sell at 25% profit, and then I set it up to rebuy once it falls to that level where I bought in the $5. But instead of, say, buying in for $5 again, then I'll buy in at $6.20, including the profit. So I'm using the profits that I'm making on the trades to rebuy in once it falls to that previous level again. Does that make sense?
Well, look, yeah, I do. I think there's a risk. So let me share the benefit of my experience from what you're saying. And I've built algorithmic trading systems across commodities and equities and futures, you know, over many, many years in the past. One of the tests that we often used for prosecuting whether or not we should continue with a trading approach is to just compare it to buying and holding. And so you've made, I think you were saying you've made a 33%, was that right? Was it about 33% that you said you've made over the 37 months? Is that correct?
Yeah, yes, I've grown my portfolio by 33%. In total, yes.
Yeah, okay. And then you said that most of your gains were in the last 18 months, right? Well, here's the question. Did you make more money, or would you have made more money if you just bought and held the underlying asset instead of traded? And the interesting thing is, over the last 18 months, Bitcoin, for example, I'm not looking at Ethereum at the moment, but in the last 18 months, Bitcoin's up 180%.
Yes, so I buy and hold Bitcoin. I never sell Bitcoin. Yep. I also buy and hold Ethereum.
So part of your gains have been due to the fact that Bitcoin has risen by 180%. Now, it may not have done that, and if it's risen 180%. And your total has been 33% over 37 months, then it's been one of the major contributors to your return. So I would suggest that if you remove that component from your return, have a look at your ratio of wins to losses, and then also have a look at the size of the wins versus the size of the losses, and that might give you a better reflection over your trading success.
Okay, thanks for that.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah. Okay. No problem. There's lots of... this is something really that I did as part of my job.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah, I really appreciate the advice. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Craig. Good on you.
Okay.
Apart from trading in these currencies, Rog. Let's talk about interest rates.
Sure. There's a lot of – look, I love this topic because it's a gift for people like me. It's a gift that keeps on giving, right? There's always something to talk about in terms of interest rates, and markets are always reacting to them. But I reckon it's a massive waste of time. It's a complete distraction for most investors. So, you know, this is a bit of a 101 on investing. But look, first thing to say about interest rates, humans suffer from something called representativeness. It's what cognitive psychologists, the way to describe it is we often take the recent past and our experience of the recent past, and we simply assume that that's going to continue in the future, which makes humans really bad at predicting turning points or changes. We're really, really good at predicting the present continuing. And what's happened is we've come from a period of rapidly changing interest rates. We've come from a period where interest rates went up really fast. In fact, they rose at a speed that was arguably unprecedented, both in the United States and in Australia. So now what we see when I read economic commentary about interest rates, often the economist or the forecaster, the interest rate forecaster, the market strategist or the investment strategist is predicting a continuation of volatility in interest rates. So half the economists think rates are going to go up again, and half of them think they're going to be cut. In fact, at the start of this year, the market view or the consensus view was that the US Federal Reserve would cut rates 6 times this year. And that's changing. In Australia, the expectation was that we'd see 2 to 3 cuts this year, and even central bankers said that that would be the case. The harder thing to predict is a change to that environment. And what do I mean by that? Or that narrative, that we actually go from a period of volatile interest rates to a period of stable interest rates. And in 12 months' time from today, Phil, you and I are still talking about whether interest rates are going to change, and they haven't. And I think that's the more difficult, least predicted scenario. Everyone's still predicting some change because we've just come from a period of a lot of change. But as I say, the harder thing to predict is that the once rapid changes in rates stop changing rapidly and we enter this period of stability. But I think all of that is a major distraction. I don't think it actually matters. What you want to do is simply buy businesses that can grow their earnings at double-digit rates, so be it mid-teens or, you know, 20%. And there are an extraordinary number of businesses around the world and in Australia, small caps particularly, or smaller companies in Australia, that are actually doing that. Why is that important? Well, this is the 101 lesson. So here's the thing. I mentioned earlier something called a PE. So what that stands for is price to earnings, and we call it the PE ratio. And what that means is if a company is earning, let's say, $5 per share of profits, and the shares are trading at 25 times earnings, then it's 25 times $5. The shares are going to be $125 each, right? So that PE ratio is kind of important to understand. It doesn't have a lot of information in it. It doesn't tell us what the shares are actually worth. But what it does do is it reflects the popularity or otherwise of the stock market. So in other words, when PEs are very high, then stocks are really popular, or a particular share of a company or a particular company might be really popular. When the PE is really low relative to its history, then that share is really unpopular, or the share market in total is really unpopular. And so the job is not to predict whether whether the stock market's going to be more popular or less popular because interest rates are changing. The key is to find those businesses that can grow at double-digit rates, grow those earnings at double-digit rates. Because if it does that, let's say, for example, you buy a stock on a price-to-earnings multiple of 15. I'm just picking a number out of the air. It doesn't really matter what the number is. And in 5 years' time, I sell it on the same PE. In other words, the popularity when I sell the stock is no different to its popularity today, but the earnings of the company in that time have grown at 20% a year, then my return from owning the shares will be 20% a year. And that's something that is inescapable. Okay. So if we can buy those businesses, like, and I'm predicting here that these businesses will continue to grow at double-digit rates, but Lovisa and ARB and Macquarie Technology and Megaport in Australia.
No business continues to grow at double-digit rates.
Not forever. No. Not forever. We only need to do them for 3, 4, or 5 years, and we'll get that 20% return per annum. And what could happen is that their popularity goes up because they've demonstrated strong earnings growth. And so we've seen that time and time again. So instead of focusing on interest rates and what's going to happen to interest rates, we should be having conversations about which businesses are likely to grow their earnings at 15 or 20% a year for the next 3 to 5 years. Do that and interest rates won't matter at all.
Okay. A few texts here. Will Hagen, much respected motoring journalist in Australia, of course, and the father of Toby, has texted saying, from the early days of motoring, here are the companies that are still going. Ford, Mercedes-Benz, Peugeot, Renault, Rolls-Royce, all still going.
So yeah, that's right. And so I mentioned earlier in the US, there's been 2,000, and there are a few that are still going. Ford is one of them, but Ford was bailed out during the global financial crisis by the government. So my point was that there's only one out of the remaining manufacturers in the US that wasn't bailed out by government or private equity in order to survive. And Ford was one of those that was bailed out.
Greg says, and ain't this an eternal truth? Greg says, I've got a friend that trades in Bitcoin and he's always banging on about how much money he's made, but he's never sold any, so he hasn't made anything. That is an eternal truth too, is it not, Roger? As my dear old mother, my dear old mother-in-law once told me, she was an investor, she said, Philip, you've never made anything until the money is in your bank account. Doesn't matter what the statement says.
I wrote a piece for The Australian back in June last year pointing out that cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, or particularly Bitcoin and gold, perform a function, an investment function. I don't think they're investments that are any good in the long run. But what gold and Bitcoin are they're now becoming a hedge against what we call monetary inflation. So price inflation is when the price of oil goes up, or the price of petrol goes up, or the price of, you know, a punnet of strawberries goes up. That's price inflation. Monetary inflation is when central banks increase liquidity in the financial system. So, for example, they buy bonds under what's called quantitative easing. They buy bonds, they use digital cash, they use a digital transfer of money to a bank to buy the bank's bonds, and then the bank goes and uses that for its trading with other banks and to loan out the money to commercial borrowers and so on. And so when liquidity increases, that's called monetary inflation. And what we're seeing is that Bitcoin and gold are becoming hedges against that monetary inflation. So in June last year, I wrote about monetary inflation accelerating and that Bitcoin and gold might be two places to invest. And if you go back to June and look to today, gold and Bitcoin have done really well. Then in January this year, what happened is that after 10 years of lobbying, the SEC in the United States, which is the same as the ACCC, ASIC here in Australia, they approved the issue of spot Bitcoin-backed exchange-traded funds. Now, that's a lot of lingo. But what it means is there are some ETFs or exchange-traded funds that could now be traded on the NASDAQ or traded on the New York Stock Exchange. And the only thing backing them, the only asset that they owned was spot Bitcoin or Bitcoin itself.
Okay.
And so I thought that when these ETFs launched, that there'd be a rush of money going into them because it's a lot less complicated to own an ETF on the NASDAQ than it is to go and buy Bitcoin. Bitcoin's, there's a bit of a palaver in getting a wallet set up and so on. And so I thought there'd be a lot of money rushing in. And when the money rushed into these, and we talked about this on your program, Phil, here on the program, at the start of the year, with all that money rushing in, those ETFs would be forced to buy Bitcoin, which would push it up, and that would encourage more money to flow into these ETFs, and it'd be a virtual circle.
Okay.
And that happened.
All right.
And so I don't want everyone to think that I'm against Bitcoin, because I actually bought some on the back of that thesis, which went against all of my better judgment.
I'm surprised, Roger. I'm surprised, Roger. Yes, go on. And what happened?
It turned out really well, simply because I know how bubbles form. You get more buyers than sellers, and the launch of these ETFs would mean that there were more buyers coming into the market, and that would push Bitcoin
up. For the moment.
And so for the moment, that's right. I've now exited.
I want to take Adrian.
I don't know what's going to happen next.
Okay, I want to take Adrian's call. Adrian from Byron Bay. G'day, Adrian.
Evening, gents. How are you going?
Yeah, pretty well, thanks.
G'day.
I'm just listening in here while we're waiting for the New York Stock Exchange to open so I can close a few trades. So good timing there.
Well done.
Hey, just a question on, historically, my understanding is that every time the US Fed have printed money substantially, then they've held interest rates. Interest rates have gone up higher. They've held interest rates. And then we're seeing a significant correction, decline or crash. I think we saw that in .com. We saw that in Great Depression. And I think, you know, there's two other periods. It's interesting at the moment that America's on knife's edge waiting for any impulse regarding, you know, interest rates dropping. Yet historically, we're, you know, potentially lining up for another major correction then.
So look, there's two things which is important not to confuse. So there's printing of money by Treasury, and that increases the supply of money, which reduces the price of money. So that has an effect potentially on interest rates and bonds, because when the currency falls, if you're printing a lot of money, the currency declines because you're increasing its supply, then it falls. And so the use of that money declines. And so the buying of bonds declines. There's less demand for bonds. The bond price falls, interest rates go up, which is what you were talking about. But the way that central banks have avoided that is to actually buy bonds. So they've increased the supply of money by buying bonds, which increases the demand for bonds, raising the price of bonds, reducing the interest rate on bonds, and keeping stock markets supported. So there's an important distinction, I think, there. And it's important to know which one, be it the Treasury or the central bank, is actually engaging in. Common sense, the GFC, it's been quantitative easing, which is the central bank, US Federal Reserve, supplying an increase of liquidity through the purchase of bonds.
Adrian?
Big answer there. So thanks for that. Obviously, we don't need to be overly concerned then.
Yeah, okay.
Well, look, you know, everyone talks to me thanks so much for that. Everyone says, what about the US debt? Look at the US debt. You know, they're going to go broke. Well, here's the interesting thing. The debt has been going up since World War II. You know, it's been going up. It's never gone down. It just keeps going up. And as long as its trading partners' debt keeps going up, the US dollar will still be the relatively safest place to be. And it will continue to be the reserve currency. And so everyone else will turn a blind eye to the US debt if they've got their own debt issues. So the game continues. You know, there's no reason why today the US stock market or the US economy should collapse under its mountain of debt, because everybody else has a lot of debt too.
Here's a thing. We discussed this about a month or so ago on the program. We got a lot of dismay and pushback about it as to whether or not money is a thing anyway. Steve from Elizabeth Bay says, Phil, does money actually exist anymore? Don't banks simply create money digitally? After all, it's just numbers that get transferred from one place to another. Well, we discussed it in the context of what banks do, and the short answer is that, yes, banks do just create money. And it's not as though there's a set box of dollars in the economy and those dollars get circulated around. It's not like that, is it, Roger?
No, we actually have a velocity of money. So when we print a dollar and we put it in the hands of a consumer, then that, you know, that the process of buying and selling and that money then creates an expansion, a leveraging effect in the economy. And so, yes, there's you know, arguably more money than there's ever been before. And so in a sense, it's not real, but as your mum once told you, value is in the eye of the beholder.
Hey, just before you go, just quickly, we've got the 3 or 4 minutes. You, as you predicted the program last year, 2024 has indeed seen private credit become one of the big growing categories for new investment. How do you get in? What is it, and how do you get into it, and what should you watch out for?
Okay,
you got 3.5 minutes.
Okay, so I said on the program when we talked about this that private credit is lending outside the banking system. Now, that might immediately draw gasps of fear amongst people, but basically what's happened since the global financial crisis, bank regulation around the world and the requirement for them to be stronger and safer has meant that there's a lot of lending that's no longer profitable for them. So that they've pulled out of a lot of business lending. And as a consequence, you know, 10 years ago or 15 years ago, Phil, you'd said, I want to lend to a medium-sized corporate directly. I would have said, mate, you've got rocks in your head. You know, that's a really dangerous thing to do, because 15 years ago, that was the domain of the banks, the big four, and all you would have left is the rats and mice, and they wouldn't be very good quality. But since then, banks have pulled back. There's now a $200 billion gap between what small and medium enterprises in Australia and medium-sized corporates in Australia need and what banks are willing to lend. So what's happened is we're seeing this growth of private credit supporting Australian business through lending money that is supplied by private lenders, hence the term private credit.
Hang on, this is so, where bonds have got its money from, and look what happened to them.
Well, bonds are different because bonds are listed.
No, not bonds. Bonds are the aeroplane, airline.
Bonds are, yeah.
They got their money from private credit, and look what happened to them.
Yes, well, they were private equity owned, and that was a business that was arguably unprofitable. So you do have to look at the portfolio of loans that the private credit fund is lending to. It might be, for example, that you know you don't want to lend to property developers. There are private credit funds that specialise in lending to property developers, and you might say, well, no, that's not for me. It might be that they, you know, because they're growing so quickly, there's now a lot of them. But there's only a few with a long track record. So you want to look for a, you know, 5, 6, or even 10-year track record. And you want them to be diversified. You know, are they investing, are they only lending to 5 borrowers and all of their loans are big and there's only 5 borrowers?
How do you get into it, Roger?
Well, if you Google private credit or, you know, you could go to our blog, for example, where we discuss private credit in detail. And do you mind me saying what the blog address is, Phil?
Sure.
Yeah, it's rogermontgomery.com. So, you know, we've been talking about this stuff for years, and I've written a lot of articles on the subject which have been published in the Oz. So if you're a subscriber to The Australian, you can see I've talked about private credit there. But your first job is to do some research. You want to look at the quality of the borrowers. You want to look at how diversified the loan book is. Some of these funds have lockups, Phil. You could be locked up for 12 months. There are others that don't have any lockup. You get your money out with 1 month's notice. You want to understand those differences, and of course you want to look at the returns that are achieved. But you know, there are plenty of private credit funds out there at the moment with a long track record of providing monthly income, and they've generated 8, 9, 10% returns.
It's an investment
class. Over the last 6 years.
It's an investment class, and it may pique your interest. Have a look at it if you so decide. Roger, we've got to go. Time's beaten us, but I do thank you for it. We'll talk again down the track.
I look forward to it, Phil. See you again soon.
Thanks, Roger. Bye.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.